dance on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Mark Tedeschi, AM and Queen's Counsel, the former Senior Crown Prosecutor for New South Wales. He has practiced as a barrister in the criminal courts for over 40 years. He is also an award-winning photographer, and since 2012, when he published his first book, Eugenia, an author. Mark is also the author of Murder at Mile Creek. Mark, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Yes, thank you, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
So, Mark, perhaps we could start by you could tell us what happened at Mile Creek on that day in June 1838, 180 years ago.
On that day, there were approximately 28 Aboriginal people who had been living peacefully at a station called Mile Creek Station, which is in the New England district near the township of Bingara, which is not far from Inverell. They'd been living there peacefully for some months, and a group of 11 armed stockmen mounted on horseback came to the Mile Creek Station, where these 28 Aboriginal men, women and children were camped, and they tied them up, led them away and massacred all but one of them. The one that wasn't massacred was a very attractive young woman who was kept alive to service the sexual pleasures of the stockman for the next few days before she in turn died from her injuries. Not every single member of that tribe perished. There were two little boys who, on seeing the stockman approaching, jumped into the Mile Creek, swam to the other side and escaped, and their descendants are still alive today. There were 10 or so of the more able-bodied men who were working on another station doing bark cutting at the time, who weren't massacred then, but it's suspected that the group of stockmen went searching for them over the next few days and most probably located them and massacred them as well.
It's such a dreadful story. And it starts with something against the law anyway, because the land holdings up there at the time were not legal.
No, it was outside what was known as the limits of location, so there were no Crown grants there. They were literally squatters. But the squatters were generally the very wealthy landowners who had large flocks of sheep and herds of cattle, and they would send their assigned convicts out with these cattle and sheep to these remote locations where fertile new lands had been found, just basically took them over and expropriated them from the indigenous communities who had been living there for millennia.
You mentioned just then there were some survivors from this massacre. I presume they were the Aboriginal survivors.
Every year since the year 2000, there's been a memorial service or memorial commemoration held at Mile Creek, to which survivors, not just descendants of not just of the survivors come, but also descendants of the perpetrators, descendants of the white people who did the right thing at the time and brought it to the attention of the authorities. So there is this marvellous ceremony of reconciliation that has taken place every year now for 18 years at Mile Creek, in the vicinity of where the massacre occurred. And it's a very, very moving ceremony. I've been to three of them, and each time there have been more people attending, Indigenous people, white people, descendants, people who want to recognise that what was occurring at that time in the colony of New South Wales was an attempted genocide of the Aboriginal people to remove them from pastoral areas to make way for the sheep and the cattle of the large white or the wealthy white landowners.
And to put this in a modern context, you've described this as something like the war crimes and perhaps even the Nuremberg trials as to what these white settlers were doing?
Well, 11 of the 12 perpetrators, because there ended up being 12, because one of the white stockmen from the station joined the 11 who had come from other stations, so there were 12 in all, and 11 of them were eventually arrested and charged with murder, and a trial took place in Sydney. Actually, there were two trials in Sydney that were conducted by the then Attorney General, John Hubert Plunkett, and those trials were really quite unique in the history of colonial Australia, in that never again was there to be a prosecution for mass murder of Aboriginal people by whites. And when I look back at these two trials and the way in which they were conducted, it was obvious that they were different to ordinary murder trials, that Plunkett really was putting the whole of society on trial for the way in which the Aboriginal people were being treated and were being massacred. So I compared it to a war crimes trial, but of course war crimes trials were not to happen for another 150 years or so, but it was so innovative, so daring, so brave of Plunkett to conduct this trial, because it was met with hostility from the vast bulk of the European community in Sydney and throughout New South Wales.
At the time, the white population was something like 77,000, and of that, you've said 36% convicts, 64% free men. Were they on the side of what you call justice, or on the side of the letter of the law?
These trials were one of the very few issues that united the landowners, the military, the newspapers, the convicts, the ex-convicts. Just about all of the white population of New South Wales was united in opposition to these prosecutions. The convict community thought that, with some justification, that the people who had been arrested and charged were all convicts themselves. They were assigned convicts who were doing what their landowning masters had wanted them to do. So it was considered by the convict population that the convicts were really the scapegoats for these massacres, and that really the white landowners who they were representing should have been on trial, perhaps even more than the convicts who had physically carried out the massacre.
Yes, and some of them, well, all of them, I guess, did get away. I mean, Dangar, we might know from Dangar Island and some other places around the country, he was the owner of the property, and he escaped completely.
Yes, Henry Dangar was the owner of Mile Creek Station. He was never charged. In fact, he gave evidence on behalf of one of the 11 accused stockmen. He gave character evidence for him and was cross-examined by John Hubert Plunkett, the prosecutor. The owner of the station where the majority of the stockmen who'd committed the massacre came from was a man by the name of Fleming. His brother, John Fleming, was the ringleader. He was a free man. All of the others were assigned convicts. And as a freeman, Fleming was able to evade justice, but he went into hiding for 2 years and only came out of hiding when the government had lost all appetite for any further trials. And he lived the rest of his life in freedom and with a degree of prosperity as a farmer in the Hawkesbury River Valley.
He was also in charge of removing the evidence. I mean, you've been able to establish what actually happened on that day, and it started with, I think, a shot from Fleming, but then they didn't want to waste their bullets, which sounds very much like the Nazis and the Chinese in modern times. But it was a gruesome scene, wasn't it?
It was a very gruesome scene, because there were mainly older men and women and children. The adults were tied together. They were in a fenced paddock, and they were basically hacked to death with swords or trampled underfoot by horses. So it was a very gruesome scene, and then their bodies were literally hacked into bits and placed onto a pile of wood and set alight in an attempt to destroy the evidence.
We might, having set that scene, we might just take a short break. We're speaking today with Mark Tedeschi, who is the author of Murder at Mile Creek, Trial That Defined a Nation. So, Mark, would you like to pick a song for us to play?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. What I would like to request is one of the Elgar cello concertos, maybe the concerto in E minor. It was a favourite of my late mother, Ruth Tedeschi, who was a great fan of this station when it was known as 2MBS FM, and she used to listen to it almost every day of her life.
And I noticed that your book is dedicated to your immigrant grandparents, Ernest and Margaret Curtis, or Cohn, and Guido and Rosina Tedeschi.
That's correct, yes, indeed. They fled Europe, fleeing persecution, came to Australia and had absolutely wonderful lives here in Australia. And they were very, very fortunate to be here before the war. My maternal relations arrived in May 39 and my paternal relations arrived in August 39. So they really only got here just in time. And I think it's fair to say that particularly for my paternal grandmother, she had a life here in Australia that she could never have had in Italy. She became a lecturer in Italian at Sydney University and was there for 25 years. And as a woman and a person who was not a member of the aristocracy in Italy, she could never have aspired to achieve that in her country of origin. So, yes, Australia's been very good to my family.
Thank you.
And that was Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor, as chosen for us today by our special guest, Mark Tedeschi, who is the author of Murder at Mile Creek, The Trial That Defined a Nation. So, Mark, we were just speaking about this this terrible, gruesome scene. Your predecessor, I suppose, as acting the Crown Prosecutor when this matter came to trial, was confronted by a lack of evidence, wasn't he, to actually tell the court what had happened.
Yes, John Hubert Plunkett, the Attorney General of New South Wales, conducted the prosecution. In those days, all murder trials were conducted personally by the Attorney General. There had been an eyewitness to the massacre, an Aboriginal, young Aboriginal man who was a servant working for Henry Dangar, who was on the property at the time. He was not touched by the marauding stockman because he was employed by Henry Dangar.
Regarded as a piece of property, I guess.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Indeed. And at the instruction of one of the hut keepers, George Anderson, who tried to convince the stockman not to take the Aboriginal people away, this young Aboriginal man kept his distance as the mounted stockman took the Aboriginal people away, but hid in the bush and witnessed the massacre that occurred. But because he was Aboriginal, he was not entitled to give evidence in court, and so Plunkett had to conduct a trial with a whole lot of other witnesses, including George Anderson in particular, who gave evidence of the Aboriginal people being led away and hearing a shot in the distance about half an hour later. And about the discovery by William Hobbs, who was the manager of Mile Creek Station, of the pile of burnt bodies several days later, and a whole lot of other evidence. Plunkett had to conduct this trial without using this young Aboriginal man, whose name was Davey, who had actually witnessed the massacre itself. There were two trials, as I mentioned. The first trial resulted in an acquittal, which generally in those days meant that was the end of the matter, because in those days you could only have one victim at a time in a murder trial. But Plunkett decided he would conduct a second trial with a second victim, and it was in that trial that he achieved a conviction against seven of the 11 men who'd been charged with the massacre. And in those days, of course, there was only one sentence available for murder, and that was the sentence of death. And these seven men were hanged in the George Street Jail in December 1838. So, as I say in the book, it marks really the only time that white men were brought to justice for the mass murder of Aboriginal people. And we know now from a lot of research that's been done in recent years that there were hundreds and hundreds of those massacres all over Australia, in every state and territory. And we know more about this massacre at Mile Creek than any of the others because of the trial. So this site at Mile Creek Station near Bingara has come to represent the massacres that occurred around Australia, and I think that's why there's such a great interest each year on the June long weekend when they hold a memorial ceremony to reflect on the tragedy of what happened and the tragedy of the many massacres that occurred all over Australia.
And what worked neatly for the perpetrators of these crimes is that the Aboriginal evidence, even if there were survivors in the massacres or there were witnesses in some other way, but they were not allowed to give evidence.
That's correct, yes. The theory was that to give evidence, you had to take an oath. To take an oath, you had to have a belief in punishment in the afterlife. In the way that the Christian religion predicates. And, of course, Aboriginal spiritual beliefs had nothing in common with any concept of heaven and hell and punishment in the afterlife. And placing one's soul at risk of eternal damnation, concepts like that. So Aboriginal people were not able to give evidence at all in any criminal matters or civil matters in courts in New South Wales for many, many years after that. And Plunkett tried no fewer than four times to have the law changed to allow Aboriginal people to give evidence not on oath. But each time he was defeated by his colleagues on the Executive Council. And I think that was well and truly after he ceased being the Attorney General that finally Aboriginal people were allowed to give evidence in New South Wales. And I might add that New South Wales was one of the last jurisdictions in Australia to allow that. We were very behind the trend at the time.
And a side effect of that, I suppose, is that although this was regarded as a long trial at the time, it certainly wouldn't compare with the length of trials today.
No, it was the longest trial that had occurred in New South Wales at the time. It went into the second day. A comparable trial today would go for at least 3 months, maybe even up to six. Yes, there are many changes that have taken place.
And just looking at the bigger picture, what do you think was the aim of the non-Indigenous people in not pursuing the white perpetrators of atrocities like this?
Look, it was there were economic factors. The Aboriginal people stood in the way of the advancement of the pastoral interests of the colonialists. There was an ongoing frontier war occurring with occasional attacks on white assigned convicts, occasional attacks on sheep and cattle. The Aboriginal people at times were placed in a situation where they were literally starving because the native animals had been displaced. Their water holes were completely polluted by sheep and cattle. So it was an ongoing war for territory. It was an ongoing war for use of the land. It was an ongoing war to exterminate the Aboriginal people and remove them to make way for the pastoral interests of the white landowners. We can look back at it now and see that that's what it was. But at the time, the white community had a great fear of the bush. They had a fear of the Indigenous people who could move around the bush so freely and emerge out of the bush suddenly. There was this fear of the unknown, fear of a land that was so different to the land that they had come from. So all of those factors played a role in causing these massacres to occur and in the resulting failure in almost every case of any justice to be done in response to the massacres.
And yet I'm pleased to note there are at least four white people to be proud of in this whole episode. The Magistrate Day, the prosecutor or the Attorney General who became the prosecutor, Plunkett, the second trial judge and the foreman, all were necessary to actually get the result of justice.
Yeah, there were a number of people that really deserve mentioning for their bravery and for their forthrightness. And it starts with Davey, the Aboriginal man who was prepared to place himself at risk by following the caravan of death to where the massacre occurred. Then George Anderson, the stockman who attempted to prevent the massacre from occurring and reported what had happened to his station manager. Then the station manager, William Hobbs, who wrote a letter to the governor and a letter to the nearest magistrate reporting the massacre. Then the magistrate himself, who was asked to conduct an investigation by the governor. That magistrate was Captain Edward Denny Day. And I suppose also the governor himself, Governor George Gipps, who instructed Denny Day to conduct an investigation and arrest the perpetrators. Denny Day did an exemplary prosecution, exemplary investigation, and arrested the 11 men and brought them to Sydney for trial. And then, of course, John Hubert Plunkett, who made himself very unpopular in the white community by conducting the prosecutions. The second trial judge, William Westbrook Burton, also made sure that there was a very fair trial that was conducted, and he obviously had a great sympathy for the Indigenous people. And finally, you mentioned one of the foremen. Mm-hmm. In the second trial, the original verdict that was announced was one of not guilty, but one of the jurors put up his hand and told the judge that the wrong verdict had been delivered, and so the judge had the charge or charges read again, and back came the correct result, which was guilty. So that juror faced a lot of criticism from the newspapers at the time and from his community for having converted a not guilty verdict into a guilty verdict. So he also deserves to be commended. So there are quite a few people who were associated with this case who did the right thing, and that was really because of all of them combined that justice was able to be done. If any one of them had failed, it would have been a different result.
Are there lessons from Mile Creek?
I think there are lessons to be learnt. The case stands for the capacity of the British criminal justice system, which we've inherited, to achieve justice for those at the margin of society. But it also shows that in order for that system to work properly, it requires a number of people, a number of good people, to do the right thing. So the system depends upon people doing the right thing to see that justice is done for those who are oppressed, those who are on the margins of society. And when it functions properly, the criminal justice system has the capacity to treat all people equally. I think that it also causes us to look at the current war crimes trials that have taken place in recent times in various parts of the world and see how important they are. They're a very much a developing area of the law in various parts of the world, and I think we can look back and just see how important that aspect of our modern legal system, our world legal system, is. So I think all of those lessons are important.
Just remains for me now to thank our very special guest, Mark Tedeschi. Mark, thank you very much for being on Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Bill.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.